For Thursday, and thanks again, members, for the staying around for the evening meeting yesterday. That was very helpful, and I thought we learned a lot. We're going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Marjorie, do you? Oh, I say, if those of you who are regulars to the committee say Janet Atkins has changed. No, you're right. It is Marjorie Taylor who is filling in for Janet today, and we appreciate pinch hitting for us.
Thank you for the opportunity. And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 21 establishes the Coos Bay Channel Fund for deepening and widening the navigation channel. The bill authorizes issuance of a $60 million lottery fund bond fund and specifies conditions that must be met for those grants to occur. In front of you in your packet, you do have the Dash 2 amendment that I'm sure some of your guests will want to talk to you about. And this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. All right, I ask Representative Morgan, Representative Roblin, and Senator Berger to come forward. And it looks like two of them will handle the job well.
Yeah.
Krieger's.
Oh, is Krieger here? Oh, all right, I didn't see you on my list. Come on up, Representative Krieger.
We have a couple of
people. Okay, all right. All right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Joanne Berger from District 5, and I want to thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 21 today. We're going to be very brief because we have other folks here to talk about actually the meat of the bill. What I'd like to just say to you is that this bill was a culmination of an awful lot of work, 18 months in the interim, and through some modeling and other things, we came out with the best project for the state that we could find, and that happened to be in my district in at the Port of Coos Bay. And now I'd like to turn it over to Susan Morgan to talk a little bit about the Dash 2s.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Metzger and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I'm a state representative from House District 2. And very briefly, I'm sure you're wondering about why someone from the Interior Valley is interested in the port, a port in Coos Bay. I'm part of a regional work group of people that Senator Verger's talked about that's worked very hard to consolidate a vision in the region for job creation. And this bill, this concept, has regional support, and I'm here to kind of demonstrate that support. What I'd like to do is take you through the Dash 2 amendments. You have a couple of visuals in front of you. One of them is this, which I think all of you have seen before, and it describes the work of the regional work group. And if you have a few minutes, it's great reading. You also have a schematic drawing that looks like this, which is the visual of how the financing works for this project. So kind of keep that on the side of your plate there while we go through the Dash 2 amendments. First of all, the amendments are the result of a group of people getting together. The port was at the table, represented from the governor's office, representatives from Treasury, Economic Development, Justice, Legislative Fiscal, Legislative Council, and legislators were all involved in the drafting of these Dash 2 amendments. Senate Bill 21, when it came out of Legislative Council, was in the same shape as I'm sure bills that all of you had, where it didn't really reflect what we had as a vision for the bill. And so the Dash 2 amendments reflect a much more focused look at it. The first 17 lines of the bill simply amend into Senate Bill 21 a more narrow geographic location, so it focuses down where the actual work is going to take place. On the bottom of that, the lines 18 to 22, and then over on the next page of the bill, down to line 10, are simply renumbering. Line 10 it removes page 3 and 4 of the bill and inserts the language that's in black on the Dash 2 amendments. Section 3 of the bill limits the needs of the project to $60 million plus costs for the bonding. The second section of it sets up a series of increments for the money to be dispersed. And what to very quickly understand this, I would refer you to this visual. And the visual, the big boxes on the visual are the three bienniums, the first one being the 07-09, the next one the 09-11, and 11-13. And what the bill does is set up, if you look at the light blue line, line that says Senate Bill 21. It shows you that in the first biennium, there needs to be $5 million of that $60 million disbursed, that the trigger for the disbursement of that money is the cargo terminal developers' board of directors stepping forward and making a commitment to fund this project and go ahead with it. That $5 million will go to the Army Corps of Engineers, who will do a Section 203 process that will result in all of the environmental permitting and the environmental work being done. In the 09-11 biennium, there's a need for $10 million of the $60 million to be dispersed. The trigger for the disbursement of that is that the Army Corps of Engineers has made a favorable recommendation on the project to Congress, and that the matching $60 million to this has been obtained from either federal or private sources. That $10 million will go to do the engineering work on the project that will result in the drawings that will govern the actual widening and deepening of the channel. In the 11-13 biennium, $45 million will need to be dispersed, and this is the money that will actually pay for the widening and the deepening in the channel. The trigger for that is dredging contracts being in place between the Port District and the dredgers. So basically, the next sections of the bill, the whole of Section 3, describes those triggers and that financial construct there. Section 4 of the bill just is pretty standard language that allows the Oregon sponsors to go ahead and make agreements with federal agencies that relate to the project. Section 2 and Section 3 over on page 4 at the top of the page just state that the state is not liable. Again, very standard language in many of these bills that you've already looked at. Section 5 sets up the financial structure for disbursement. The funds will be dispersed through economic and community development, and just lays out the things that need to be in place in order for that to happen. So very respectfully, what we're asking the committee to do today is to move the Dash 2 amendments into the bill and then refer the bill down to the Ways and Means process so that we can continue the discussion in that arena. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions, and if there are none, I will turn the proceedings over to my colleague, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. I think we'll go ahead with Representative Roblin.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, my name is Arne Roblin, representative from District 9 in Coos Bay. I'm here because as I worked in the work group during the interim, and then when I finally met the company that was actually coming here, which is APM Maersk, which has the opportunity to do this, I was totally and completely impressed with the kind of company we're talking about. I think it's the third largest shipping and port managing company in the world. So we're talking about putting the Port of Coos Bay in line with any other port around the world in their capacity to unload and move cargo, and we know right now from all the studies we've done that the West Coast is going to be in dire need of port facilities of this nature. From California at the and Oakland and in San Francisco to Los Angeles, Long Beach to Seattle, they're getting clogged. We have an opportunity to make our state, and not just Coos Bay, our state, one of the key transportation links for the Asian trade. And I cannot underscore how important it is to have the kind of company that we're talking about here willing to invest in our community. You know, we talk about our $60 million investment and hopefully the federal government's $60 million in the dredging. But the other investment between $250 and $400 million on the site and the people who are going to be employed will turn the economy of my community around. And having been a principal and watched the slow erosion of our community because of fewer and fewer students and fewer families and fewer family wage jobs, this is exactly the kind of economic development we need in our rural communities, which will tie into the economy of the whole state. The projections, and you'll hear more about that, list anywhere from 4,000 to 7,000 jobs statewide being produced because of this. A major economic boon for our area, and I hope one of those things that turns our community around so that we start having the family wage jobs in our community that bring back kids and other things to our schools, and we stop having what has been a 20 or 30 year decline in our community. So with that, I'll turn it over to Senator Verger to wrap up and answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, every year, with every passing year, Southwest Oregon gets more tourists, more retirees, more artists, and more opportunities for the state of Oregon. The first one that knocked at our door in Oregon, the world-class golf courses. Now we have the second knock at our door with a world-class shipping company. And so we are so proud of our port there, and we're proud of the opportunities, and we're very happy that other people see the potential that the port has. So I would encourage you today to add the Dash 2 amendments into the bill and to pass it to Ways and Means. And thank you very, very much for hearing us.
Well, thank all of you. Questions for our colleagues? Okay, thank you very much. Who on my list is your primary
we
presenters?
Have the port director, Mr. Jeff Bishop, his chairman of the board,
David
Mr. Kronsteiner.
Okay.
David Kronsteiner.
Let's have them come forward then.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bishop. I'm the executive director of the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I have with me today our president of our commission, Mr. Dave Kronsteiner, who's going to add some comments at the end of my presentation. Briefly, the concept of an Oregon gateway was, for lack of a better term, hatched sometime back early on when I first got to the port. After having spent some time at the Port of Tacoma and working with the siting of the new terminals there and trying to find location for an ever-increasing expansion of the port, it became quite evident to me that there was going to be a shortage on the West Coast, a severe shortage of space for container operations in the near future. I had the opportunity to be in Coos Bay on a project trying to relocate an existing tenant from the Port of Tacoma to make room for one of those container terminals when I happened to cross this piece of property, and it struck my eye, and as happenstance would have it, the port was at the same time was looking for an executive director, and short of it is, here I am today. The opportunities for this facility are relevant, and if you look at the trade growth that has been occurring in double digits over the past few years on the West Coast. Our client, who I apologize that I'm unable to disclose the name since I'm still bound by a confidentiality agreement, has done quite a bit of market analysis and has developed projections that indicate that even on a conservative growth rate of about 4%, and assuming build-out of all the ports, and assuming the build-out of new ports in both Mexico and in British Columbia, there's still going to be a shortage of adequate space on the West Coast. That's even factoring in after the Panama Canal is expanded to a third lane and capable of handling vessels that are capable of transporting up to 12,000 TEUs of containers. TEUs are the measurement of containers, if you're not familiar with that. Containers originally were in 20-foot increments and now mostly are 40-foot in length and have traditionally been referred to as a TEU, which is a 20-foot equivalent since that was the original standard. Their indication is that there's going to be a shortage of over 5 million TEUs on the West Coast, even if everything is built out and productivity is increased. That led them to a West Coast search for an additional location, and they went through an extensive review and extensive siting process, and then finally selected Coos Bay as one of their finalist sites. Unfortunately, in evaluating Coos Bay as a potential site, there's two pieces of infrastructure which are basically threshold requirements. In other words, the vessels have to be able to call the port, which requires a certain depth. The vessels that we're talking about are about 1,300 feet in length, 185 feet in width, and require a depth of at least 49 feet. And normally you want 2 feet of underdraft underneath the vessel to accommodate safe travel. Our authorized depth currently is at 37 feet, and the width of our channel is only 300 feet. In order to safely traverse these vessels, it would need to be widened to 500 feet and to 51 feet. The client has identified a development date of 2014, and are currently involved in detailed analysis to determine the feasibility. And with that, I'd like to point out some, or refer to President Kronsteiner, who's going to highlight some of the components of the bill and how they relate to the project.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify. Senator Verger and Representatives Morgan and Roblin have done a pretty good job of laying this out, but I'll be brief, but I will add a few things. One of the first things that we want to talk about is the three biennium request and the protection that it has for the state budget. In the first year, as Senator Morgan or Representative Morgan pointed out, would be a $5 million request. That will help us fund the studies for this project. Now, if we don't go beyond that, then the rest of this money will not be spent. And so we have protection all the way along. Earlier this week, I met with Congressman DeFazio to ask if the federal government could help with their part of that. And part of the reason we're here is that they are so slow to move. But I have agreement that they're going to make some efforts to help with some of the funding also. So we'll see where that goes. But we're working hard on a lot of different avenues to try to make this happen. The other part of this project is this is not a if we build it, they will come thing. This is, will we build it if they come? And we have a pretty strong commitment from this terrific customer that Representative Roblin talked about, and I have the same feelings about them. They are the type of people that we want in our community. They have a great record in this country with the way that they represent themselves, and their company culture dictates that, and they live by it. So we're happy to have this particular company knocking at our door. And as Jeff had stated, if we can fill these two needs, the rail and the dredging to allow the ships into our port, I believe we have a good chance of making this happen. This is an investment that is measurable. We're here asking for $60 million to help this project along. We have had a study authorized that would indicate that when this is up and running, the state taxes that would be generated by this would amount to $21 million a year. And to me, as a businessman, that sounds like a pretty good return on the investment that we're making here. This also greatly enhances the Port of Coos Bay's position in the world trade. We no longer ship to the Northern Europe and the Mediterranean as we used to, and Australia. Our shipments now mainly our trade goes to Japan. This will open up Southeast Asia and the China trade that is becoming so important to this country. Because of the intermodal rail aspect of this project, it will preclude thousands of trucks from being on the road. So we are approaching it that way and protecting our highways that way. This project also will greatly enhance the viability of the port to handle other shipping traffic and the non-commercial and recreation vehicles. At this point, Coos Bay is the safest harbor access between the San Francisco area and the Seattle area. And by deepening this channel, we will only improve that and make a safer port for every vessel that calls on Coos Bay. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you, and we're certainly willing to answer questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kronsteiner. Well, my first question would be, you know, put on the naysayer hat, is as the Port of Portland will attest, you know, with Hanjin and others, that, you know, companies can come and tomorrow leave. And so when you talk about, you know, you feel good about the commitments if they were to make this decision to come and initiate port to call at Coos Bay, you know, what type of guarantees besides that we like the place would you envision with the shipping line, because obviously you'd be investing a lot of money to get there. I'm just kind of curious as to what the level of commitment on both sides would be. If there's any contractual way you can do that, or...
Well, Jeff can speak better to the contractual way that this will happen, because I believe there will have to be that for this project to happen. The port will have to have a contract with them to make it work. But their investment is expected to be upwards of $700 million in this facility, and I think that would be a pretty good investment for them and the chance. Also, the due diligence we've done and we've looked at is their intent is to establish more facilities than the Port of Coos Bay, so this is one of more that should follow along, and they have stressed the need to continue to supply the facility for the shipping traffic that's coming.
Questions from the committee? Yes. Senator Decker.
Can I ask this kind of the same question just a different way? Is there any way, if we allocated $5 million in the upcoming biennium, pick your source, if we did it, is there any way that that $5 million would result in that company, and this gets at the contract question, not coming?
If you did not appropriate the
no.
five, is the question...
we allocate five.
You allocate
is there
five.
Any way in the contract that you are promulgating with this company that if we allocated $5 million, that company at that point could... $5 million's gone.
Right.
That company would not locate in Coos Bay.
The risk that is apparent in that process is that if you were unable to get a permit, if the process of analyzing the impacts of the channel project indicated a impact that was deemed to be unacceptable, and permits were not issued, then that would certainly be one way. There could be market pressures. But I think to speak to some of the amendments that have been proposed to you today, we have developed a risk-based approach to this in the sense that each segment of the appropriations are triggered by a commensurate commitment from the company. If I could go back and further elaborate, Mr. Chair, the investment of the company, comparing this particular development to an operation like you would have at the Port of Tacoma versus what we would refer to as an operating port, like the Port of Portland, where they own the facility and operate the facility, customers come and go. This situation, we're talking about long-term contracts, huge amounts of capital that are being invested by the private company in the facility that they will have creditors involved with that will not allow them to walk away in a timely fashion. Plus, we also in the industry will place in contracts minimum guarantees so that certain volumes are guaranteed and a fee structure is developed on that basis. So from the incentives involved in the process encourage a long-term commitment. That's why they take so much time and so much effort in doing their due diligence to perfect the business model before they build these facilities.
So, Mr. Yeah. Chair, the two-thirds, and I completely agree. I'm just kind of wearing that naysayer cap also. Completely agree. We hope it's a long-term. The company seems phenomenal. I mean, if you look through the information that Senator Verger provided, it just looks like a phenomenal company. I guess the two things I heard were there could be market pressures and there could be permit, because it is an unnatural act for us to put $5 million out there with that caveats open of permits, we'd want to learn a little bit more about, and then market pressures is a very broad, there are market pressure, that's just a very broad opening that the state could then have expended $5 million, and I would hate for the opportunity to be, well, the market in Chicago did not turn out to be what we thought it would be on the eastern half, and therefore we appreciate the $5 million investment of the state. It was an important investment, but we've made market decisions because this market didn't turn out to be the way we...
We certainly could approach the client about some clawbacks, some type of mechanism that would, in the event that that happened, provide some type of clawback so the state could recapture its investment. I'm not sure how they'll react to that, but it's something we certainly could proffer and see what the response is.
My one vote would be dependent on that, that there's some level of, if we put $5 million, that we are reimbursed if they decided not to move forward.
I'll take Senator Montesanderson and then Vice Chair Stark.
I'm interested in, I think I heard you say that right now the width of the inlet is 300 feet and needed to be increased to 500 feet. And what type of environmental studies and mitigation, have there been preliminary studies on this issue? Because that seems like a huge amount of land that we need to widen.
If it pleases the chair, Senator Anderson, the inlet to the port is over 1,000 feet wide. It's the channel, the authorized navigation channel, that is shrinks down to 300 feet in the
300 feet? Okay.
It is 400 feet in the upper bay, in the area that was traditionally the heavy maritime commerce center in the port. At this time, there's no indication that the entrance itself would need to be widened. It's the navigation channel once you're inside the lower bay.
And you're saying that's how many feet?
The entrance is over 1,000 feet wide now.
Okay.
And allow me to address the other part of your question. There's a two-year study process involved in this where those impacts will be analyzed and evaluated, and that's the purpose behind the $5 million is to pay for that actual study.
All right, thank you.
Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate your testimony. Appreciate the direction that I think this project will continue to improve the economic situation in the Southern Oregon coast. I think most of us on this committee have supported sending lottery dollars to Coos Bay, North Bend for airports and pipelines and other things. So I see this as continuing the revitalization and redevelopment of a great part of Oregon. Couple of questions. It seems to me that the $120 million total that's on this piece is a lot of money. And I guess I'm comparing it to the amount of money that we're currently spending on the deepening of the 100-mile-long Columbia River Channel. And it doesn't seem to compare when you have, 8 miles of channel in Coos Bay and 100 miles of channel in the Columbia River. Can you talk about why is this so expensive for such a shorter, kind of more condensed piece of for lack of a better word, real estate?
If it pleases the chair, the estimate, three issues. One, we can't foresee what dredging costs will be 6 years from now when the project is expected to commence. Secondly, while it's only 8 miles, it is estimated to be about 10 million cubic yards, which my understanding of the Columbia River project was about 10 million cubic yards based on our conversations. The difference is the relative depth that we're talking about. The Columbia River was 3 feet of dredge, and we're talking about, from an authorized standpoint, of 37 to 51 is considerably deeper. Although I would point out that's we're talking from an authorized depth, not an actual depth. If you look at the soundings of the lower bay, we do have a lot of 50s already in many places in the bay, and in fact I think the most shallow location in the lower bay now in the channel area is in the 44 foot area until you get to one sandstone formation, and I'll come back to the sandstone formation in just a moment, which is at 39, which is the depth that it was last dredged to by the Corps of Engineers when we went from an authorized depth of 35 to 37 feet. We developed a schematic sensitivity analysis, if you will, and looked at all of the dredge costs that we have seen up and down the West Coast. We've had some conversations with different contractors, and on being on a conservative side, pick the highest number of yards, assuming the worst case scenario and trying to foresee what dredging costs will be at that particular time. We didn't want to come into a situation and have project creep where we keep coming in and saying, well, we're having this little escalation, there's this effect that's going on in the economy, it's affecting it. We certainly hope it'll be a lot less than that. But we're rather conservative in our approach to business, and we want to make sure that we are on the conservative side. I would point out that the amendments actually effectively index, if you will, the cost to the federal cost share. So it doesn't necessarily mean that all $60 million will be allocated and spent on the project. It simply sets a limit on what the state can reasonably expect that their share of the project would be in the event that they chose to sponsor the project.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that response. I understand kind of the range and the risks. And, you know, we're familiar with those issues as we do budgets around here as well. So appreciate that. The next question kind of that I have is you talk about bringing in a lot of containers. And all the word that I've gotten from everybody that's pitching this is that those containers are going to go on rail. I would suggest that they can't go on rail. From my understanding, the Class 1 rail lines are pretty doggone at capacity. And it's going to be tough to find. I mean, it's if you're bringing in the amount of containers you're talking about bringing in, and I don't see anybody from UP or BNSF, maybe one in the back, and they're not signed up to testify. Do you have commitments from the rail, the Class 1s who are ultimately going to pull these trains, but also you've got short lines that are going to get you from Coos Bay to, I think, up to Eugene, I think is the route. My understanding, my belief, correct me if I'm wrong, that that short line is would have to have some significant improvements in order to carry all these containers. So that's number one. And is either the Class 1s or that short line, have they talked about improving the rail line on their own dime? Are they and you and all the coalition folks going to come back to this legislature and say, thanks for the $60 million to do the dredging, now we need $30 million to upgrade the rail lines, and in my belief, you're not going to be able to get them all on rail anyway, and so you got to, I think it's Highway 42, are you going to ask us to come in and spend, tens of millions of dollars to upgrade that as well. So I think that those are issues you can answer them briefly now if you like, but those are issues that I think moving forward are ones that the numbers are going to have to be crunched pretty hard. And I think that we as a legislator, I'll speak for myself, I want to do my best to help support what I think is important economic development in that part of Oregon. Mm-hmm. But tough questions. We need to sharpen the pencils and figure out how we're going to make this all pencil out.
If it pleases the chair, I think the drafters of the bill were very clever in the different decision points that they have laced into the language of the bill. None of the funds are available to the client until such time as the client commits. The client is actively engaged in a dialogue with their potential partners. All of those business decisions have to be ferreted out and proven from a business model standpoint before they will make that commitment. That will include a careful and detailed analysis of the rail. We do know that there's been considerable amount of engineering analysis that has taken place on the rail line. We do know that a dialogue exists between the client and different railroad entities. Those issues will have to be perfected until such time as that occurs. We do not anticipate this client will commit. So that being said, I think it's almost inherent that those issues that you speak of will have to be brought to light, discussed, and if there's a policy or a physical impact to the state, those will have to be vetted, certainly with many more folks than just the people involved on the business end of this deal. So that being said, I don't think commitment will be forthcoming from the client until those things are addressed and understood. And if they do not commit, then there's no funding from the state as the act prescribes.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Thank you, gentlemen. What we're going to do, we're going to ask now that Rob Douglas and Ralph Groner come up. And then after they come up, we have three people signed up in opposition. I have a funny feeling it looks like they have the same topic, so I'm going to have them just come up together, and then we'll move on. Are we doing the bottle bill today? Oh, no, I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Rob Douglas, representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. This is the association of agents for the vessels, the people that bring the Toyotas in and take the wheat out of Oregon ports. We are here to support the Port of Coos Bay and this bill, Senate Bill 21, with the dash two amendments. A little history. Coos Bay used to get 25 to 30 vessel calls a month. Now we're down to maybe 4 vessel calls a month. It's very tough to socialize the costs over only 4 vessels to have an active port. So we view this as a positive bill and a positive thing for the Port of Coos Bay.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. My comment will be short. I would only say, one, that Coos Bay is one of the rural counties undergoing terrible distraught over the timber issue, which possibly could be vetoed. Those are all my members. Those job losses have all been my members. From the city are my members, the county my members. So I do have a special interest. However, I would like to comment that this is one public employees union who steps forward and says, if I'm going to be asking Ways and Means and you for money, then I put Ask Me on the line in supporting economic development. And so let me give you what I see this analogous to. A few years ago, all of you worked very hard on OTIA. Behind the scenes, I worked exceedingly hard with Bob Russell to get the truckers to come along and put the $3 million in that we did. I see a similarity in that OTIA now employs, for those who don't know, Oregon Transportation Improvement Act, but they may be in the audience, don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's your measure. Employs over 20,000 employees. When they talk about family wage jobs, these are folks that are bringing in many millions to this general fund right now in income taxes. And the fact is, these are Bob Shipwreck's members, for the most part, not mine, unless it's county bridges, and some are, and city bridges, those are also mine. I testified for OASIS, just so you'll see I'm not inconsistent for once in my life, because I can't be supporting biofuels, which I think will grow the economy in Oregon, without adequate water for the biofuels industry in northeastern Oregon. I now support the Port of Coos Bay, not only because have the longshore become my friends, and that city and county, which I worked out of and lived in when we were near strike, I have become very close to how distraught that community is. But to me, this has state-wide impact, comparable to OTIA, comparable to what OASIS could be, comparable to what the governor was talking about industrial permitting and having ground ready, even though this is water. I would certainly think maybe that measure you passed may need to be amended. So to me, city, county, state all benefit. My members will benefit at the city level because of property tax, county level because of property tax, and at the state level because, similar to OTIA, income taxes that come into this general fund. So at the heart of what I have to say, as our longshore friends of mine have been decimated, the hall is empty, and those folks are now working out of Port of Portland, and the town, compared to what it was in the heyday, has become a ghost town. But it's really not just about Coos County and the city of Coos Bay and all of the Coquilles of the world and Bandons, also my members, of that area of the state. The fact is, this is a gigantic economic opportunity for the state of Oregon to do just the same wonderful work you did with OTIA. So we support this measure, and we wholeheartedly endorse the project.
Thank you, Mr. Grover. Any questions for any of our guests? Thank you very much. Okay, my last three people are Dan Serres, Jody McCaffrey, and Steve Jones. If you guys all want to come forward. If you have written testimony, please hand it out there. We have about 10 minutes left for this bill. So we'll let you divide it up however you want. 3, 3, and 3, or?
Sure. 2, 4, and 4.
Or 2, 4, and 4?
1, 4 and a half.
Welcome. Whoever wants to start.
Well, I suppose I'll start. My name is Steve Jones. I'm a Coos Bay resident, and I represent an organization called Organized Citizens for Environmental Action Now, Ocean of Oregon. My primary issue here is, I want to come out and I know we're up here as opposition. I am not opposing the proposed container facility, and I am not opposing the Oregon Gateway. I mean, opposing it. If you look at page one of the copy that I gave you, this is taken from the Oregon Port of Coos Bay's own website, and I've got in some little marks down here a project status for the Oregon Gateway. It says the port is in communication with a marine energy engineering and construction firm to establish project costs and timelines. Actual construction of the waterway would not occur prior to a final decision on the siting of the proposed LNG import facility. What this tells me right here, right now, is that the Port of Coos Bay has tied the liquefied natural gas facility in with your Oregon Gateway project. Things are contingent. Now, if I go to page two, you'll look at a map here of the proposed container site, and on the right hand side, you'll see where the liquefied natural gas facility is there. I am opposed to the liquefied natural gas facility. I'm trying to go through this quickly here. The Lower Bay Turning Basin, again, the same statement. Everything is dependent, the siting is dependent on the proposed liquefied natural gas import facility. We go to the next page, same thing. Significant investments by the Jordanco project in a marine waterway will provide leverage for the port to develop new cargo facilities and revitalize marine commerce in Coos Bay Harbor. Now, there's things that you need to look at here before you approve anything with the Pacific Gateway. Is you really need to take a look at the agreement between the Port of Coos Bay and the Jordan Cove Energy Project. If we're looking at this next page of recitals right here, I go down and designed by Jordan Cove Energy Project. I'll read this real quickly. It says the LNG berth area will be part of a larger marine facility that will be designed by Option E. Option E being the Jordan Cove Energy Project and the liquefied natural gas facility people. So it looks like to me that they're terribly involved with what's going on with the Gateway Project. Now, if we go turn to the next page, here's from a resource report from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Okay, that's FERC. We work with them daily. If you go to the next page in Resource Report 1, Project Descriptions, if we read that, it says, explain the relationship between Jordan Cove's proposed LNG import terminal and the adjacent container/cargo import facility sponsored by the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay, known as the Oregon Gateway Project. Provide copies of all correspondence, etc., etc., etc. These two projects, and I wish they were not linked, are horribly linked. In other words, before It seems to me before any kind of container facility can be built in Coos Bay, we've got to go through the FERC process. That means that FERC must approve the Jordan Cove Energy Project. It must also approve the proposed 235-mile pipeline down to Malin, Oregon. The port has pulled both of these projects in together, and it's not right. That is going to happen to any people in this community. We want to see growth. We want to see development. I, in particular, do not want to see the Jordan Cove Energy Project. The idea of putting 1,000 workmen working in a container yard within hundreds of feet of a liquefied natural gas facility is something that I know that FERC wants to find out about. We're looking at the FERC process, and I'm hoping that this thing will go on, you know. It may not come to a closure for a couple of years or longer. So with that, I will be done.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that.
I'm just going to take 1 minute, and then Jody's going to talk. My name is Dan Sears, and I'm with the Southern Oregon Pipeline Information Project. We, like Steve, we have no position on the container facility at this point. It's not really our issue, and the dredging is part of the container facility. What is an issue is whether this project is viable if the LNG facility fails. We all intend to see the LNG project fail. We work with landowners all across Southern Oregon who are, you know, facing a pretty serious eminent domain threat from the LNG project and the pipeline. Now, if we're successful in stopping the LNG project, it's my understanding that the property on which the land parts of the cargo terminal will sit, that deal will fall through. That property is contingent on the approval of the Jordan Cove Energy Project. That's just something that I'm asking the legislature you to look at and to figure out where one project ends and the other begins. There's a lot of members of our coalition who like the container facility idea, who support the idea that this is going to bring jobs. I personally have no position on that, and the coalition as a whole, you know, people opposing LNG don't agree. We do agree that the state needs to look hard at whether it wants to link this much funding to a project that has really huge safety, environmental, and property rights issues. And that's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi. My name is Jody McCaffrey. I have a five-minute speech. I thought we'd been given 5 minutes, but I'll just try to do the best I can.
Oh, you can probably do five because I think they were less than five together. So,
okay, I'm a lifetime resident of North Bend. I was born and raised there.
Please identify yourself.
Jody McCaffrey is my name. I formed a group, Citizens Against LNG, in opposition to the liquefied natural gas import terminal. I'm also a member of the Southern Oregon Pipeline Information Project. Our port for many years has, there's a saying, a famous saying that Mr. Kronsteiner said that if you build it, they will come. And our port has been building it and spending millions of dollars on different projects, and we have not gotten jobs. We were promised all these jobs, but we did not see that. There's a barge slip that sits, a T-dock that sits there that we spent several million on, never accomplished the jobs that we were promised. They invested in a ferry, and I think they ended up having to sell that at a loss. It didn't. And the Coos County Pipeline was promised that the industry would come, and we still are out on how much that's going to cost us in the end on that one, and we still don't have actually any industry that's committed because of that pipeline. You know, a cargo terminal does have its merits, and you have to wonder, why don't we have a cargo terminal in Coos Bay? It seems like a logical thing, possibly. Well, there is a reason why we don't. In 2003, the port did this study, and it was done by Parsons Brickenhoff, I hope I'm saying that right, Ports and Marine, which is a very viable company. They did it's a feasibility analysis for a modern marine cargo facility in the port of Coos Bay. They looked at actually three different sites. Actually, the sites that they looked at are probably better than the Oregon Gateway, since the Oregon Gateway does sit on a wetland. I think these sites may be better. And they did a very thorough analysis, and I did not make 20 copies of this. I'll be happy to leave this one if you like. We tried to get more copies from the facility. There's none. They came to the conclusion that a cargo terminal actually, and they gave some very good reasons, it would be a kind of a risky business adventure and a probable money loser, and they listed all these things that needed to be looked at. And I'm just asking that these issues be addressed in some way, that it just not be forgotten. It was only in 2003. That wasn't that long ago. So I don't think we should be shoving what they have said under the rug. We need to really look at it. And maybe they are looking at some of these issues. It hasn't been forthcoming. Okay? You have to understand that the before we sink a lot of money, $60 million is a lot of money, but you know what? It's going to cost a lot more than that to do all this needed, to put in the infrastructures that you will need for a cargo terminal. And I'm not against a cargo terminal. As a group, we're not against. But one of the issues we have is that the port has linked this Oregon Gateway project to the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas. This is all in their land purchase agreements. And it also is in a couple articles that I have here that came out in our paper. This was in 2005 when Mr. Bishop says, the plan isn't complicated, but all of it is contingent on siting the liquefied natural gas terminal. And in another article, the same thing is said. The Port and Urban Renewal Agency would be partner on this, and Bishop said the loan would be contingent on successfully siting the liquefied natural gas project. So these projects are linked. The Oregon Gateway is part of the land deal, and I lost my slide. There's a strong opposition to the liquefied natural gas. I just submitted over 2,500 signatures to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on a petition that is still ongoing of people that are opposed to this. So we ask that this be looked into, not be taken lightly. We're not. I don't want to say that. You know, I hate to come up and say, don't give us money, because a lot of times the money doesn't come to the South Coast. We do need the help, and it ends up going to Portland, and we do want to have the funds to support projects. I just don't want to see another port boondoggle. I want this thought out, and I do want to commend Senator Verger, you know, for her efforts. I know she's trying really hard, and I don't know that she has all the whole information about the linkage of these, but as far as a group, we really do not oppose a cargo terminal. We do want to see the area successful. We just want to see the right development there and the development that the people there that are happy with. So as we don't know if it's linked, we're going to have to oppose it. And part of it is that the dredging, the slip dock is definitely for the liquefied natural gas. Part of that dredging is a slip dock. That is for the LNG. There's no question that dredging is linked. So I'm just asking you to consider, and I can't do it in any more time, but I mean, it's very detailed, and if you want to have some more time and I can explain it detailed, I'll be happy to do that. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCaffrey, and I appreciate the written material you have provided. It's always very helpful, and I appreciate the research done on that. And I mean, certainly the topic that you have reached is always a real controversial one, just mm-hmm. downriver from me, the Columbia River. It's a big issue with that as well, so right. I appreciate the complexities of that. Questions for any of our panelists here? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think, members, clearly, I know a lot of work has been gone into this project, and as these folks themselves have mentioned, you know, there's still a lot of questions. They're going to have to take some additional time on that. And I think one of the points that was made by Senator Deckard about a clawback provision, something that would give us some comfort that could maybe worked on in ways and means to address that. I think that's some direction we might give them to take a look at that. And the proponents have seem willing to have that discussion. I think it'd probably the best thing for us to do, if you're willing to do that, I think let's send this down to Ways and Means without recommendation, so that they can continue this discussion in a more expansive and get more issues on the table. Because as you know, our deadline is fast approaching, and I'm not sure we're going to have our committee time to have that time. They'll have much more time in Ways and Means to look at this, as well as looking at it. And I think the proponents certainly know this in the big picture with all the other requests that we have for economic development, so that we can size these up in Senator Johnson's committee. And if that's okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 21, open a work session on Senate Bill 21, and ask if we could adopt the -2 amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr has moved the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 21. Any discussion? Any objection? Sorter.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 2 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 21 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Just one quick point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just one quick point. Obviously, if we don't move this bill, then that effectively, it doesn't have a chance unless it's in Ways and Means. And so I think we've got to move ahead. But would ask the port director and the port president to continue that discussion with the client about getting us that assurance that if it does, and that would be a great success, come out to the House floor and the Senate floor, and that would be a huge success for the South Coast, that it has some strength in that area.
That's a good point, Senator Deckert, and I'll ask that Janet Atkins put together a letter on behalf of the committee to the Ways and Means Committee on that issue, that this is an issue we want to have addressed, and some of the concerns that was addressed today, to have those addressed and as part of that discussion down in Ways and Means. With that, again, if there's no objection, it's so ordered, and Senate Bill 21 on its way. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 21. And where are we going next, Marjorie? We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 782. What do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 782 allocates $200,000 in lottery funds to the Science and Technology Partnership Program beginning the 1st of July of this year, has an emergency clause, and this also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Gee, looks like peanuts compared to last one, $200,000.
Yeah,
I mean. Welcome, Senator Monroe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Rod Monroe, State Senator from District 24, Mid Multnomah County. The Senate Bill 782 was introduced by myself at the request of the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership and its chair. The chair of the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership is Hiroshi Murahama. He could not be with us today because he's in Texas. But I brought instead somebody that's almost as good, the president of Mount Hood Community College, Bob Silverman. This is a request for a measly $200,000 for the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership to continue its work on wave energy, biofuels, carbon fiber-based composites, medical manufacturing, and the other things that it does. The Oregon Science and Technology Partnership essentially is all about being a convener, a facilitator, a catalyst in public-private partnerships for emerging industries. And I believe that this money will generate many-fold over and will continue to make Oregon a leader in developing various emerging industries, especially with respect to alternative energy sources. And that's basically all I wanted to say, and I'll let somebody that knows a lot more about this, the president of the community college, speak and get back to Ways and Means where they may need my vote.
Okay.
Bob is in our community college. I serve also, by the way, on the board of Mount Hood Community College. Mount Hood Community College is very involved, of course, in these various projects. And Hiroshi Murahama, besides being president of the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership, is a prominent member of our foundation board. So, Mr. Silverman.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. Welcome, President Silverman. Good to see you.
Good to see you. For the record, my name is Robert Silverman. I'm sort of an unusual position. I guess I'm an emeritus board member of OSTP and also community college president for Mount Hood. It was sort of a strange story. When I was a founding member of the board and they finally decided they wanted me off, they made me an emeritus, but when Hiroshi couldn't come today, he calls me. So
now we know what emeritus means.
I guess so.
The other guy can't show up.
You trot him out. And for the record, it's Murahara is Hiroshi's last name. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am here to support the ongoing funding from the state, which augments the funding that the partnership derives from the local cities. This is a statewide effort, but focused on the East Metro area. We are dedicated towards economic development, towards creating a workforce, a technology base, a research base, which will support emerging technologies for the state of Oregon. In the beginning, we began in the areas of biotechnology, and we started with partnerships with our universities, our community colleges, and our business partners in the area. As time has gone on, I became emeritus. I guess I mentioned that to you once. And we also have branched out a wee bit, looking at more and different technologies. And the one that is particularly interesting to me is the one with the biofuels and the cellulose-based biofuel production process that the partnership is exploring. We're very interested for Oregon to participate as a trainer of employees for biofuels and biofuel development. It would be very interesting, since we do have a plethora of trees and a lot of them fall down, we could put all those to work making biofuels. So the college is dedicated to working with the partnership. I know the universities are very much involved. And if you look at the partnerships of the cities and the county, they've all been involved with supporting the partnership. So today we're here to request a continuation of funding, a slight increase. But for $200,000, we do an awful lot of things. I'd like to stop there and answer any specific questions you might have, if I can answer them. And I do apologize. Hiroshi asked me to say that he was sorry. He's in Austin, Texas at a biofuels conference. Yeah. So sorry he couldn't be here.
Well, thank you, President Silverman. And I noted that some of the things that you've done is working on some art with wave energy. You mentioned the biofuels, things that other avenues in which we're pursuing that and trying to explore those possible resources. Senator Mata Sanderson.
Thank you. I just want to augment what President Silverman is saying. OSTP, as we call the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership, with this money, they'll be able to host, and they already have hosted several, it's called Knowledge Connection events, which extend the economic development potential for the state of Oregon. And that includes in emerging industries, as he said, the wave energy, the biofuels, the carbon fiber-based composites, and the medical manufacturing. Another thing they do, though, is they want to develop two new knowledge connection initiatives, and one is a user-driven social networking website, which is focused on research initiatives in the state and potential business users. And this will have significant potential to aid Multnomah County's manufacturing companies in technology-driven growth, as well as to work with a business development staff to identify businesses which could use the service of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. But I am most excited about what President Silverman has already said about the pilot cellulosic biofuels project using poplar trees as feedstock. And I know that there's a lot of energy regarding corn oil, but are using corn and having biofuels with the base being corn in the biofuels industry. But this technology is just so emerging, and already OSTP is working with the University of Vermont in its steam explosion process and with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado, in its development of cellulosic enzymes. So I just want you to know that this group is truly on the cutting edge of wanting to bring some of these emerging industries to Oregon, and this will be very much money, very, very well spent. I know the Ways and Means has to decide that, but I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Mata Sanderson. My only experiences with steam explosions were always very negative, and they're usually in the kitchen. Any other questions for President Silverman? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one point. Not knowing much about the Science and Technology Partnership, we made a decision about 3 years ago that there was a number of groups working on emerging industries. We had ETIC, we had OCAD, we had an Internet Council, we had regional efforts like this, and the decision was made that we need to, and it was done in the executive and in the legislative, have one place. And we've already approved, this committee has a $38 million package, which has been whittled down to about 22 at this point, and it's now being rebuilt as of this morning on wave energy. But it was all done through the governor's appointed Oregon Innovation Council, which really is now over 100 folks. And it was this very conscious effort that we would, instead of this dispersed model where we had different people coming with good ideas on biofuels or wave, that it would all go to one place and it would be housed in one place. And then that council would make recommendations through the governor's budget process. And so that's the only pause I have with this, is that many of the initiatives that you spoke about were part of and have been a part of the seven subcommittees of Oregon Inc. They've been debated, and this was not, as far as I know, a part of that. And it was that conscious effort that the state made that we were going to get it all in one place, so that we didn't have disparate efforts and we were organized when we made an investment. That's the only pause. Happy to move it down to Ways and Means, because I know that committee is focused just on that question.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Deckard. Thank you, President Silverman.
Thank you.
Okay, our last two are Rick Gruen and Rick Williams. The Ricks.
How are you? Good to see you.
Chair Metzger and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm here both as a member of industry and the vice chair of OSTP. For the record, my name is Rick Williams, Richard B. Williams. I'm a resident of Oregon City. And for background, I'm an Oregon State University engineering graduate, a retired submarine captain, and I'm currently employed as the regional director for Global Consultancy Science Applications International Corporation, who is quite interested in Oregon as a market, partially because of the innovation that's going on in Oregon. The Oregon Science and Technology Partnership brings people together, government, university, industry, and communities, to accomplish things they could not do alone. Our partners are Clackamas County, Multnomah County, and the city of Gresham, as well as the state. Our volunteer board has geographic diversity. Eastern Oregon, we have a member of one of the tribal enterprises at Warm Springs who's heading up our composites investigation. We have the director of the Oregon Renewable Energy Center at the Oregon Institute of Technology, Tom Chester, to represent Southern Oregon. And then, of course, we have the Willamette Valley and the coast. Our Knowledge Connection events last year brought over $100,000 into the Oregon economy, and the several Knowledge Connection events you've already heard about, and Rick will talk about some of the others, including recreation technology, our value-added agriculture, and our forest meeting. The results that I have personal knowledge of that I wanted to convey, along with the positive comments of the senator and the president, I have personal knowledge that the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership helped to incubate the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition, of which I'm a member of the board. And as a retired defense acquisition professional, this is really exciting. PNDC now has 76 industry members. We were just successful in bringing $2.5 million of federal defense appropriation into the state. And my first contact with Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition was through OSTP and events that OSTP sponsored, like the trips to Pacific Northwest National Lab for this fledgling startup defense coalition. So that's real results. The Wave Energy initiative, Senator, you're right. The Oregon Innovation Council has been central in that. I testified to the Oregon Innovation Council and staffed the work to the Emerging Industry Committee as a member of OSTP. So OSTP did the staff work that provided the decision base for the Oregon Innovation Council to go forward. As a catalyst, we hosted the Ocean Renewable Energy Conference in Newport, Oregon last July that helped bring national, regional, and international players to Oregon, highlighting that Oregon is the place to come for wave energy. So I think, I agree wholeheartedly and in total support of the Oregon Innovation Council approach. There is some upfront spade work that occasionally needs to be done before that happens. who staffs the reports to the Innovation Council process is something to consider. You already heard that we attracted a new company, Finnever Renewables, to Oregon. They announced that at the conference that OSTP hosted in Newport. So, you know, we are a convener and we are a catalyst. And our next conference on wave energy will be August 10th. At Oregon State University, and I just spoke as the vice chair of OSTP with the National Renewable Energy Center or laboratory in Boulder's lead on ocean energy, who is now a confirmed speaker at our conference. So I think there is a role for advanced spade work on the biofuels front. Our particular interest is the business of biofuels, and Hiroshi Murahara is quite inspirational to watch as how he puts these things together. Partially because of our conference that we held last October, the big gorilla of biofuels, BVI, who hosts international and national level conferences, has decided to bring their 3-day conference to Portland next October, which we consider a real success. This year, our Ocean Renewable Energy Conference 2 will be hosted. The Biofuels Conference will have a companion conference to this large national group that will focus on Oregon's needs in biofuels. Our Composites Initiative, we're working across the state, eastern and southern Oregon, as well as the northwest part of Oregon, to bring things together. And our web project, what we do is really labor-intensive and connection-intensive, personal network-intensive, and we're hoping that with the web project we can facilitate that into a more repeatable effort. So I would commend to you the incubator work and the spade work that we do as a part and a partner and an input at times to the Innovation Council's efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, and I do appreciate that role that you do play in bringing these things together and making that happen. And I frankly have been very pleased with what how successful that role has been since the last session. Mr. Gruen, welcome, and I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. We do have written testimony, and we have one more bill I got to get to, and I think the committee is inclined to move the bill to Ways and Means, so you can speak off the cuff. We have the written testimony. That'd be great.
Yeah, I thank you very much, Chair Metzger and the committee. I think the other point to bring...
Oh, please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Rick Gruen. I'm a Clackamas County resident. I am chair of our county's Economic Development Commission, past board member to OSTP, OSTP, and now serve as an advisor to them. There's another component that OSTP has played, and that's where Rick mentioned the business side. There's also the grower side. And I think what we've been able to discover as we've moved forward, if we're going to have biofuels, if we're going to have bioenergy, biomass utilization, are we going to be processors of the material and import those in? Are we going to be able to tap our resources? As Senator Anderson mentioned, we do have an abundance of trees in the state. However, as we look at green building and green development, and a Portland architect who is very prominent in sustainability and green building has said to me, we can see the trees, touch the trees, smell the trees, and feel the trees, but it'll be darned if he can spec a green building project with local trees from Mount Hood. So there's some disconnect between supply and demand, and where we look at the other component of this as an economic development driver is the growing the growers side of things and working with them to be able to be producers of the raw material, at the same time be processors of those materials. And so we look at it, and in your paper that I handed you, we talked about manufacturing without walls. And that's the resource base that we have, not only in the Northwest, but throughout the state. So with that, you have my comments. I'll close it with just a thank you for your time to hear what we're doing at the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership.
Mr. Gruen, thank you, and thanks both of you for taking the time on a lovely day, finally, to come down to Salem.
Well, we appreciate
that very much. I'm close public hearing on Senate Bill 782. This is a bill that goes to Ways and Means, where we can consider it in partnership with all the other things and see what role they play in dovetailing to that and have the committee work on it down there. So with that in mind, I'd open a work session on Senate Bill 782.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the bill to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 782 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection?
It would be great to, no objection, it would be great to hold you guys formally on to that effort so that there's formal, because they're very closely linked.
Okay, thank you. Very good point. No objection. So ordered, it's on its way down. One last bill. We'll open up public hearing on Senate Bill 117.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 117 expands Oregon's no-call program to include wireless numbers, and it allows for the designation of the National Do Not Call Registry instead of operating a separate state registry.
Okay. So let's have Andrew Scholl come forward. And Paul Cosgrove is the only one that signed up. You might as well come up, too. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. I'll keep this extremely brief, but I do want to do a quick recent history. In 1999, Oregon created a state telephone solicitation no-call law. We were among the first seven or so states in the nation to do this. Under the law, telemarketers generally could not make solicitation calls to Oregonians that paid to be on the Oregon no-call list. This, of course, was with exceptions, including charitable calls, certain charitable calls, certain existing business relationship calls, certain business-to-business calls, actually all business-to-business calls, and surveys and political calls. Do Not Call List gained such popularity that on October 1st, 2003, the federal government created a national no-call registry. As most of you know, consumers can register their phone numbers on this national list for free, as opposed to the payment required by the original Oregon registry. The federal agencies charged with the operation of the federal program implemented rules that, in pertinent part, provided for mandatory mirroring of state registries with the National Do Not Call Registry, meaning states need to be able to incorporate the applicable portions of the federal list into their respective state no-call lists and vice versa, or be able to use the federal registry directly. This mirroring cannot occur in Oregon because of how the state registry is created. It's created and maintained as set by statute. The statute does not provide for receipt from or transmission to the National No-Call Registry, nor does it provide for the use of the National Registry directly. As such, the state no-call program has been effectively preempted by the federal law since October 2003, and we currently have no enforcement program under state law. Senate Bill 117 is important because Oregon's no-call law is currently unenforceable. Those who register on the federal list are not protected under existing Oregon law. States may bring an action in federal court on behalf of their residents under the federal no-call provisions. However, economic constraints dictate that the Attorney General typically only bring consumer protection actions on behalf of Oregonians in state court under state law. That is, the federal law provides no specific provision for recovery of enforcement costs for the state, and civil penalties obtained in federal court typically go to the federal government. There is federal enforcement, but neither of the federal agencies with authority to bring an action under the federal no-call law have the staff or resources to bring actions against those violators of federal law that are not national in scope or otherwise of priority to the federal government. Examples of this are those that may be operating nationally, but that may only have violations in Oregon, the Northwest, or in a small number of states nationwide, or those violators that are only operating in Oregon, the Northwest, or a small number of states nationwide. But the need is still there. Between January 1st, 2006 and December 31st, 2006, there were 15,064 complaints received by the federal program from consumers reporting Oregon as their state of residence.
15,000?
Correct. Senate Bill 117 provides the Attorney General with authority to designate the National Do Not Call Registry or similar federal registry should it ever prevail to serve as the Oregon No Call List. It provides for wireless telephone numbers to be included under state law. They are already included on the federal registry. It provides legislative assembly findings to clarify that the prevention of harmful effects is the primary purpose of the legislation. It provides for enforcement of existing state no-call law provisions in state court, and it provides for Oregonians to receive protection under state law while continuing to register solely with the Federal Registry at no charge. And just as important, businesses, whether they're Oregon businesses, national businesses, international businesses, would still only need to refer to that single Federal Registry to comply. On the question, Chair Metzger, of the 15,000 complaints, also note that there are approximately 1,600,000 registrations now that note Oregon as a state of residence. And with that, I thank you for your time, and I'd be more than willing to answer any questions you may have. I know Mr. Cosgrove has already spoken to me, so.
Okay, well, why don't we hear Mr. Richard Cosgrove, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. And I got involved in the no-call law enforcement and regulation a number of years ago when we were dealing with bank mergers and how to make sure that a bank that merged with another bank and kept the old bank's name could be considered those their customers. We had to amend the law. This bill, one piece of the history is what happened in the 2005 session. In 2005, a very similar bill, almost identical to Senate Bill 17, was introduced as Senate Bill 208, and it went to the Judiciary Committee. And under the good offices of the chair of that committee, Senator Ginny Burdick, we came to a compromise that we thought was particularly appropriate and even maybe elegant in its simplicity. As Mr. Scholl has pointed out, the Attorney General has expressed authority under federal law to enforce the federal law. It's just that he would have to do so in federal court. So the amendment that we came up with, it became Senate Bill 208A in 2005, was to allow the Attorney General to enforce federal law in state court and to receive reimbursement for costs and enforcement fees if the Attorney General prevailed. It eliminates the need to worry about all of the duplication and conforming state law to federal law. The federal law, as he mentioned, already includes wireless telephones, whereas Oregon law does not. The federal list is free, where Oregon's old list cost money to consumers. It seemed like a very simple way to proceed, and one that was met the Attorney General's concerns about having the ability to get reimbursed if he decides to enforce on behalf of Oregonians. So the 208A amendments, or a 208A version of the bill from 2005, simply allowed the Attorney General to enforce federal law as the federal law expressly provides he can, in state court, to obtain an assurance of voluntary compliance if that was appropriate, and if not, to obtain and recover attorney's fees and collection costs. Would offer that as a better alternative to Senate Bill 117 as it's before you today. Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, before we ask questions, Mr. Shore, why don't you respond to Mr. Cosgrove, because apparently, obviously, that didn't go into effect. So,
thank you, Chair Metzger. And I don't know all the reasons for why the reversion, when it was submitted this session, went back to 208, which Mr. Cosgrove has pointed out. It was very similar to the original 208, as opposed to going to 208A. We're definitely willing to work with Mr. Cosgrove and take that suggestion out.
So I guess maybe to hone down more specifically, because I remember 208A, so would you be supportive of that as what was amended in 2005?
Again, Chair Metzger, it's been a long time since I've looked at 208A, and I don't know the Attorney General's stance on that, but we will absolutely take it back and look at 208A again and work with Mr. Cosgrove.
And then Mr. Cosgrove, what about you?
Chair Metzger, the amendments that became 208A made us supportive of the bill, or at least we were neutral on the bill and resolved all of our concerns.
Okay, so I want to start with that part. Questions?
Sounds like a good plan, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so I think what we will do is revert to 208A and bring the bill back. How's that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We'll close up here on Senate Bill 117, and we are adjourned.